The events in the book of Daniel start in the book of Deuteronomy, 800 years before Daniel was taken captive by the Babylonians. In Deuteronomy 27 and 28, God commanded the nation of Israel to divide itself into two groups and to station themselves, one group on one hill and another group on another hill, overlooking a small valley and facing each other. And one group called out to the other the blessings of God that he would give to Israel if they obeyed him. The other group called out the curses God would send on Israel if they disobeyed him. So in Deuteronomy 28, verse 36, it contains part of those curses that God would send on Israel for their disobedience. That verse says, "The Lord will bring you and the king whom you set over you to a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there you shall serve other gods." So it's a warning that there will be a captivity. The Israelites and even their king would be taken captive to a distant land. But despite God's warning, Israel really did not obey him. For over 800 years, they fluctuated between moments of obedience to God and long periods of rebellion. And God punished Israel over and over again. And when he punished them, the people would repent for a little while, but the next generation would worship God and worship idols, would reject God and worship idols. In 930 BC, the kingdom of Israel had a civil war and split into two nations. The nation of Israel was in the north and the nation of Judah was in the south. 200 years after that civil war, after that split, the nation of Israel was taken captive by the Assyrians. A little over 100 years later, the nation of Judah was defeated by the Babylonian Empire. So in 605 BC, during the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, conquered the city of Jerusalem. And the curse that was announced 800 years earlier began to be fulfilled in that particular time and place. Now, Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy Jerusalem at that time. Instead, he plundered the temple of God. He took some of the items from the temple. He took various members of the royal family and noble families, as well as others, Jews, and he took them captive to Babylon. Daniel, the author of the book of Daniel, was one of those captives taken to Babylon in 605 BC. And so let's read the first four verses of this book. It says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans." So as I've already said, this morning we began a study through the book of Daniel. I at this point have no idea how long I'm going to spend in the book. Daniel's only 12 chapters long, so there's a good possibility I'll be able to finish it in less than a year. But today, I'm not going to dive into one passage. I'm really just going to introduce the book to you and survey the book. I want to show you two key truths that really are what this book is about. So the events here start in 605 BC with the conquest of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. The book of Daniel records the defeat of Babylon nearly 70 years later in 539 BC. The book of Daniel records the rise of the Medo-Persian Empire. The book of Daniel also looks into the future to describe some of the key events of the next 600 years. So Daniel foretold the defeat of the Persians by Alexander the Great, the division of the Greek Empire after Alexander's death, and the squabbles of various Greek and Egyptian rulers of the lands surrounding Israel. The book of Daniel mentions the first coming of Jesus, and then it leaps to the still future reign of the Antichrist and the return of Jesus. So this book of Daniel records six episodes from the life of Daniel, one in each of the first six chapters. The book also records four visions describing the future progress of history. The stories of the three Hebrew children being thrown into the fiery furnace and Daniel in the lion's den, they are some of the most familiar stories of the Bible. Those have been taught to millions of Sunday school children around the world. The prophecies of Daniel have been studied and puzzled over by thousands of theologians. And this book of Daniel is a fascinating book. It's full of incredibly simple, familiar things and some not so simple and not quite so familiar things. But it was finished sometime during the reign of King Cyrus, the emperor of the Medo-Persian Empire, sometime before the death of Daniel. Daniel is the main character in the book, and he is the human author. And those people who first read the book of Daniel were Jews still under bondage to the Persian Empire. And the book of Daniel addressed a major problem which confronted those captive Jews. But the problem addressed in Daniel is not the captivity of the Jews. The problem addressed in Daniel is the apparent weakness of God. And to understand the severity of that problem, we need to understand a little bit about how the ancient peoples thought about their gods. Because every nation had its own gods. All the gods were localized. Now, some were greater gods who ruled entire nations or even empires. They ruled large areas of the world. Many were smaller gods that were very restricted in their power and their territory. They were the gods of mountains or of a mountain. They were gods of valleys or of a river or of a forest. But whether the gods were great gods or weak gods, all of them were limited in their power and, in fact, were weaker when they were in the territory of another god. Now, we see this view of God at work when the Syrian army was unable to defeat the Israelites. The Syrian king's servants told him their gods are gods of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we. But if we fight against them in the plain, surely we will be stronger than they. What the Syrians thought was that the God of Israel was a God whose power was greater in the mountains, but it would be weaker in the valleys. And the Syrians thought their God was weaker in the mountains, but more powerful in the valley. So they fought Israel in the valley. They lost. They found out their God wasn't more powerful than God anywhere. But they fought Israel in the valleys. And many of the ancient peoples believed their gods were limited in both power and dominion. And additionally, the success of a nation was thought to be directly related to the strength of their God. So if a nation had good harvest, a healthy population, and much prosperity, it was because that nation's gods were strong and they had done these things for them. And when a nation went to war against another nation, the gods of those nations also went to war. We saw that already with the Syrians and the Israelites. We see it as well in the book of 1 Samuel, when the Israelites went to war against the Philistines, the army of Israel took the Ark of the Covenant with them. They thought if they took the Ark into battle, they could not be defeated. The Philistines saw what was happening, and they were afraid. They cried out in terror, God has come into the camp. What they both were believing at that time was that their gods were active combatants in war. So it wasn't just a battle between Israel and Philistia. It was a battle between Jehovah and Dagon, the god of the Philistines. And so when these two nations or any two nations collided in battle, this worldview thought the nation whose gods was stronger would be victorious. So the world believed the Babylonians defeated the Assyrians because Marduk, the god of the Babylonians, was greater than Asher, the god of the Assyrians. The nations believed the Babylonians defeated the Israelites because Marduk was greater than Jehovah. Now, when we're talking about pagan gods, this is, at least I think it's interesting history. But at the same time, it's a long ways away, and it doesn't seem to be all that big a deal to us. I don't think we really feel about it the way that they would have. I don't think we have the gut understanding of it that they would have. Because we know we're talking about mythical beings that don't exist. And so that the gods of all the pagan nations are just fiction. And so I think we sometimes hear these things like we would hear a couple of geeks debating about whether Superman is stronger than the Incredible Hulk. It's not, okay, it's interesting maybe, but it doesn't have much impact on my life. When we read the book of Daniel, we are reading about a people who have been crushed in battle by a people who truly believe their God is real and powerful. The defeated ones were the servants of the one true God. But those defeated Jews lived in a world which worshipped a wide range of gods, and they believed the success or failure of a nation reveals the true strength of their God. And now the Jews may not have subscribed to that worldview, at least not intentionally or consciously, but it was incredibly familiar to them. It surrounded them, and that surrounding culture would have pressured them to think like everybody else. So the Jews lived in a time and a place where the other gods were accepted as real, and where the reality and strength of those gods was demonstrated in the military campaigns of the nations. So what happens when your God, who you know is the only true God, is defeated in battle by the mythical gods? What happens when Mike Tyson gets knocked out by Aquaman? What happens when the Flash strikes out Barry Bonds? Or Thor sacks Tom Brady? At some point in time, we're going to be thinking, well, maybe superheroes are real. And I know that's a trivial example, but that's part of what's going on here in Israel. And to put it more seriously, and maybe in more contemporary terms, what happens to the Christian view of marriage when science conclusively proves that gay couples are better parents and give children better chances of success than parents in a committed, monogamous, lifelong heterosexual marriage? What happens to the Christian view of the uniqueness of humanity if Mr. Spock lands in Washington and proves beyond a doubt that intelligent aliens exist? That's what Israel was confronted with. Their entire worldview, everything they may have thought they knew about God, has been upended. And they are forced to reevaluate their beliefs. They're wrestling with, is this true? Their king has now a servant of other kings. The best and brightest of the nation are now slaves. God's own temple was robbed by invading armies. Would not even the most devout begin to wonder, should I rethink my worldview? I mean, many would be tempted to wonder, is God real? I mean, even the most faithful Jews might start thinking the gods of the other nations are real and they might be more powerful than Jehovah. And what it comes down to is when Babylon defeated Jerusalem, many Jews were tempted to wonder if God was in control. Was God really sovereign? And that is the question the book of Daniel answers. It is a most important question. Who is in control when the world seems out of control? And what Daniel shows us is that when everything else is chaotic and nothing makes sense, God is still in control. The unthinkable had happened to God's chosen people, but God was still in control. The most wicked and vicious of people were prospering, and the righteous were suffering, but God was still in control. The city where God had chosen to dwell was defeated, and God was still in control. The temple where God's glory had visibly resided, so that the presence of God had visibly and literally filled that temple and remained in the Holy of Holies for hundreds of years. And then some marauding pagan army comes in and robs the temple. But God was still in control. The children of God were made slaves and a laughingstock. But God was still in control. Thousands of Jews were abused and killed. But God was in complete control. Even though the people of God were in exile, God was not. He was still in complete control of all the world. And I want to show you, that's the first truth I want us to see this morning. God was actively in charge of everything that happened to the nation of Judah and the prophet Daniel. Look in verse 2. Let me read it again. It says, "And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his house with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God." The thing that is noteworthy is that in this verse, God is the first and primary actor. God is the one giving. Jehoiakim was not taken by force against the will of God, but rather God gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. God is the one who gave Nebuchadnezzar victory over Judah. Jehovah, the God of Israel, did that. Marduk, the God of the Babylonians, did not do that. Nebuchadnezzar did not take Jerusalem by the might of his Babylonian army. It was God who did all the giving. And God gave Jehoiakim and even some of the articles of the house of God to Nebuchadnezzar. God was in complete control of the defeat of Jehoiakim, the taking of the captives, and the plunder of the temple. In Babylon, Daniel was brought under the control of a man named Ashpenaz. And Ashpenaz was to oversee the feeding and training of certain of these Jewish captives. Look down in verse 9. There we read, "Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs." Now this chapter has already told us that Daniel was a good-looking young man of high birth and great intelligence. We're going to see later in the book of Daniel that Daniel is a careful, well-spoken man. And those are characteristics that are very likely to gain the favor of men who are looking for skilled servants for the king. What verse 9 does not say is that Daniel was brought into favor because of his personal qualities. It says God had brought favor, Daniel into favor and goodwill. God gave Daniel favor in the eyes of others. God was actively in control of Daniel's captivity and Ashpenaz's appreciation of Daniel. Down in verse 17, we read about Daniel and his three friends. Their name was changed to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it says, as for these four men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. Because they had this skill, these four men were promoted in the kingdom of Babylon. Now, these four men had been selected for special training because they were particularly bright and talented boys. And at the end of that training, they were shown to be far wiser than all of the wise men of Babylon. They are men who possess great personal qualities. But what this verse tells us is that they had wisdom because God had given them this knowledge and skill. The minds of those four men was under God's control. The 3 years they spent in training were under God's control. These young men faced terrible loss. Their faith in God was directly challenged by their superiors. They were physically mutilated, their identity was changed, and their diet was restricted. For them, life was incredibly difficult. But God was actively in control of everything that happened to them. If we were to keep going, and I'm not going to look at the rest of these passages, but I want to mention several. In chapter 2, verse 23, we read that God gave Daniel wisdom, might, and understanding of a dream that nobody else knew or understood. God gave him that. And God used that dream so that God would reveal to Nebuchadnezzar what God was going to do in the major kingdoms of the world for the next 600 years. In Daniel 3, God showed he was in complete control of the fiery furnace when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the flames, but come out unharmed. In Daniel 4, God taught Nebuchadnezzar a painful lesson. God showed that arrogant king that God alone gives power and secures kingdoms. In Daniel chapter 5, God taught that same lesson to proud Belshazzar when he stripped the kingdom away from him and gave it to the Medes and Persians. In Daniel chapter 6, God showed Darius, the Median king, that he was still actively involved in the life of his servant, so that God was in control of the lions to protect Daniel and to destroy Daniel's enemies. Even though the Jews had reason to wonder if God was truly in control of their circumstances, God repeatedly showed in the life and book of Daniel that everything was in his hand. God was actively involved in the lives of his people, even in their intense suffering. And the second thing we see in this book, not only God is in complete control, the second thing, and directly related to it, is that God is going to establish his eternal kingdom. God's control of the world is not random or purposeless. God's control of all things is directed to a specific end. God is moving in all of the events of the world, both international and personal, to bring history to the end that he has planned for it. So we read the prophecies of Daniel. In Daniel 2 and 7 and 8, and we learn of the kingdoms which would rule for the next 1,000 years of human history. The book of Daniel tells us as well of the second coming of Jesus. In Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, we learn that God will overthrow all the kingdoms of this world to establish his eternal kingdom. So we come to this book of Daniel, and it gives us incredible hope. And the hope of the book of Daniel is a hope much greater than earthly success, comfort, or ease. The hope of the book of Daniel is that God is in control and is establishing and will establish his eternal kingdom. the very last verse in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, it contains a promise, which is the culmination of all of the prophecies. It's where Daniel goes. The history of the world at that point in time is just brushed aside, actually. And an angel of God told a prophet of God what matters most. So in verse 13 of Daniel chapter 12, the angel says to Daniel, "You shall rest." What he's telling him is you're going to die. By that point in time, Daniel was in his 80s. It was obvious to him. I don't think he had any question about that, but he would die. The point was not that he would die, but his death would not be the end. He says, "You shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of days." Daniel would die. But because Daniel was a child of God, he would be raised to life again. There was a resurrection coming, a resurrection to an inheritance. The hope of the book of Daniel is that God is establishing the eternal kingdom where his people will have an eternal home. The hope of the book of Daniel was not that God would make Israel a great nation again. The hope of the book of Daniel is that not that God made a captive, an influential counselor of powerful empires. The point of the book of Daniel is that God rules all. Even when it seems like chaos and evil rule, God rules all. God is exercising his rule now. He will continue to do so in the future, and one glorious day he will rule visibly on the earth. And the hope of the Christian, the hope for any of the people of God, is not a hope that God is going to make everything better in this life. God never promised that. Daniel never escaped captivity. In fact, I don't think Daniel even saw the rebuilt temple, any part of it. The hope of the believer is not that everything is going to get better now. We hope, we expect, we anticipate God will make everything right and perfect in the light, in the life to come. Our hope is that the suffering and sorrow of now is not meaningless. It's not out of control. Our hope is that God the Son is coming again. Our hope is that we will have a place in his eternal kingdom. Our hope is an eternal home in a city whose builder and maker is God. That's what Daniel's pointing us to. God is in control, and he has an eternal kingdom where his people will live forever. But Daniel is not just, if you will, pie in the sky. Daniel is immensely practical to how we live today. How do we live in this world of sorrow and sin, knowing that there's a kingdom coming that is ours? How do we live in this world when we feel like outcasts and outsiders? How do we live in the hope of eternity when right now we are suffering physical, emotional, and relational agony? And Daniel, just broadly speaking, teaches us three ways to live in this world, because we know that God rules now, will rule forever. The things he tells, that Daniel teaches us, is first, do not disengage from God. Second, do not disconnect from the world. But third, do not be directed by the world. Do not disengage from God. To say it even more specifically, be active in prayer. Daniel's life was characterized by prayer. In Daniel 2, Daniel was still a young man, probably in his mid-teens, and he was confronted with death. His first recourse in that time of trouble was to pray. In Daniel 6, Daniel was an old man, probably in his late 70s or early 80s. And his enemies realized the only way to get Daniel in trouble was to make prayer illegal. And so when the king forbid prayer to God, Daniel prayed anyway. He had a long-standing habit of praying three times a day, and he would not forsake prayer even to please the most powerful man in the world. In Daniel chapter 9, we read the prayer of a man who obviously had a lifelong habit of talking with God. Daniel prays like a man who knows God's word and who knows God. He prays like a man who had spent countless hours praying to his God. He prayed with passion and honesty and humility and power. Daniel was a man beloved by God because he never backed away from God. The sorrows of his life did not drive Daniel away from, but to God. And the book of Daniel teaches us the sovereign and eternal rule of God ought to drive us to a deep relationship with him. When life becomes difficult, painful, or chaotic, run to God. Because God rules all now and he will be your king forever, pray. Develop a close relationship with him. Pray and do not let anything keep you from prayer. So do not disengage from God. Second, do not disconnect from the world. The book of Daniel shows us how hope beyond this world keeps us properly engaged with this world. Daniel had at least 70 years of opportunity to pull back from the world. He could have refused to cooperate with his captors. He could have refused to advise the kings that enslaved him. He could have given them bad advice. In the early days of Daniel's captivity, we know he had few choices. He was taken against his will and forced to assimilate into a different culture. Daniel could, though. He could have slacked off. He could have shirked his studies. He did not. The very few clues about Daniel's life in this book suggest that he was a man who took his job seriously. He was a part of a world, a kingdom, and a culture. He had a role in that society, and he took that role seriously. Daniel did not let his religious devotion or his submission to God's rule become an excuse for laziness or disinterest. And because God is returning, because our hope as Christians is not in this world, we in fact are uniquely positioned to be a part of this world. If our hope is not in this world, we are actually better able to be more objective about the things of this world. If our hope is in God's eternal kingdom, we're better able to engage this present world. We'll be better able to do our work, to build relationships with others, to sacrifice our goods, to serve others, and to serve God in this world. Our citizenship in heaven does not teach us to pull away from the world around us. We are not called to be hermits. We are not called to live in monasteries, convents, or communes. We are called to go into the world and serve God well by being an active part of the world. But the third thing is that while we are active in this world, we must not be directed by the world. We must not be influenced by the pressures of this world. We must not be conformed to this world. We must not compromise God's commands to please the world or gain its favor. We see this in Daniel 1, and we're going to look at this next week. We see this in Daniel 1 where he and his friends purpose to not eat the unclean food from the king. We see this in Daniel 3 when Daniel's friends refused to bow before the king's statue. They said, we might burn, we will not bow. We see this in Daniel 5 when Daniel told a terrified kinglet that he could keep his rewards and promotions because God was about to take his kingdom away from him. We see this in Daniel 6 when Daniel refused to stop praying even though it could have cost him his life. I cannot overstate the pressures put upon Daniel to conform to the iniquity and the immorality and the idolatry of the world around them. And he absolutely refused. And he would not excuse the least compromise in his obedience. He could have presented good and reasonable arguments to eat the king's food. He could have closed his windows while he was praying. He refused to change anything about obeying God. He was going to do nothing but total obedience. Because God rules and God will rule forever, we must not permit the world to turn us away from obedience to God. We must resist with all of our might the pressure to be conformed to this world. And we resist conformity by refusing the very first small and excusable compromises. We must always do what is always right. And we must refuse anything but complete obedience to God. So the book of Daniel teaches us that God rules over all of life, even the life-changing, heart-breaking circumstances. God rules as actively in control of all things, even when it doesn't seem like it. God not only rules now, he will rule forever. And we who are his people have an eternal place in his eternal kingdom. Therefore, we must live within this world with the hope and the assurance of God's eternal kingdom. We must live in close fellowship with God. We must engage this world, and we must refuse to be conformed to this world.